Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least three times a month, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, as always, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today in episode 484, we bring you a preview of the November-December edition of Retinal Physician in 2025. This last issue of 2025 covers a few topics. I'm very happy to be joined by Drs. Kat Talkart and Sarwar Zahid to talk about tyrosine kinase inhibitors. We talk about sustainability of fluorinated gases used during retinal surgery and pneumatic retinopexy. And we end with a discussion of best practices for clinical trial sites, as well as how to pick a fellowship for those of you in fellowship selection season. As always, these articles can be found online at retinalphysician.com. I hope you enjoy this discussion. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is back with a preview of the November-December 2025 edition of Retinal Physician. As a reminder, Retinal Physician can be found online and in print at retinalphysician.com. And I'm very happy to be joined for today's discussion for the end of the year. I can't believe it's the last one of 2025. It's also the first episode of the 10th year of this podcast, which is also crazy. Kat Talcott from Cleveland Clinic. Kat, welcome.
I can't believe it's been 10 years. What an achievement for you, moderator extraordinaire.
Thank you. I thought you were going to say something different, but I'll say it after I introduce Sarwar. And Dr. Sarwar Zahid in New York. Sarwar, welcome.
Thanks for having me back, Jay. Happy decade.
I thought Kat was going to be like, what does this mean? Or like, what is the meaning?
What does it mean?
Like, I don't know if it's meaningful, but it's okay. We're having fun.
Entered into your mid-career crisis yet?
Mid-career crisis. the best way to talk about mid-career crisis is to talk about TKIs, right? Everyone's favorite topic du jour. So this first article was written by a friend of the program, Priya Vakaria. She wrote Investigational TKIs for Retinal Exudative Diseases, vorolanib, axitinib, and I am not even going to try, migalindranib may offer sustained and targeted therapy for neovascular AMD and DME. Thank God for brand names at some point, because I don't think I could say milgadendronib to patients if that's ever FDA approved. So just to recap again, I'm just going to recap quickly. You can read the article online for all of these if you're interested. Priya talks about some things we talked about in this program before. If you've listened, you know, most of our treatments have been targeting VEGF, but there are other pathways, including the TIE2 pathway and the IL-6 pathway. And, you know, we are trying to expand to other pathways. And so tyrosine kinase inhibitors may address other receptors and other sort of impacts. And they're used in other fields, oncology being the most prominent. But there are multiple TKIs being looked at for exudative retinal diseases. The ones that are closest are DURAVYU, AXPAXLI, and then Clearside has taken axitinib also for suprachoroidal injection. But there's also other ones from Alcon and Ashvada, which are being looked at, including the aforementioned migalindranib. I'll say it the last time now. So, and they talk about some of the differences that was seen. DURAVYU is a bioerodible drug delivery platform, gives a daily therapeutic dose for 6 months, inserts 94% drug, 6% matrix, and doesn't contain anything in it that would be cornea toxic, which is a little different than Ozurdex. And it is a preloaded syringe injection. They talk about some of the phase one and phase two results. The phase two DAVIO 2 study showed two doses of EYP 1901, now called DURAVYU, versus EYLEA 2 milligrams every 8 weeks. And it was very sustained and not vision outcomes with non-inferiority and obviously less frequent dosing of the DURAVYU insert. 6 months after a single dose of DURAVYU, 63% of patients did not need supplemental injection and treatment burden reductions of 89 and 85%. That was for neovascular AMD and for Verona was their trial for DME. Very similar results, 73% of DURAVYU 2.7 milligram patients were supplement injection free and then no safety events. And right now, Lugano and Lucia are their trials for neovascular AMD that are looking at 2.7 milligrams of DURAVYU every 6 months versus aflibercept every 8 weeks. Now, one thing that wasn't really emphasized here, which is important to note, just as an aside, when we talk about this, these patients do require preloading with the aflibercept. So it's not that you're switching them out for this new drug. You preload with the aflibercept, then you give the DURAVYU on top of that. Axitinib, you have the Clearside drug, which is suprachoroidal. You have AXPAXLI, which is intravitreal from Ocular Therapeutics. And it's a soft PEG hydrogel designed for release over 6 to 12 months, and it's delivered via intravitreal injection. As I said earlier, there were phase one trials that showed maintenance of vision compared to baseline, and 61 and 80% of patients remain supplement free in the arms for the treatment dose, and treatment reduction in the US-based trial was 93% at month 7 versus pre-trial treatment. Again, these were previously treated patients that were being looked at Ocular Therapeutics trial. And SOL-1 and SOL-3 are the phase three trials that are ongoing. We should get data not too long, beginning of 2026. It talks a little bit about Clearside, which is looking at suprachoroidal, which my takeaway is the different delivery mechanism. The benefit would be no floaters, visual disturbances you might get with injections, but didn't seem to offer a huge difference. It was effective, but it wasn't a huge difference in terms of treatment burden reduction compared to intravitreal. And then Alcon has the product combining it with a bioerodible polymer implant for sustained drug release. And then you also have, I won't say it this time, the Ashvada drug that's being looked at. Anyway, it was a long explanation, but this is a good review, Kat, of where we're at. I think the TKI, not war, but race has been on for a while. I think we're probably going to get a lot of data in the spring. I mean, I think the biggest adjustment, I was just talking about this, as I told you guys, was giving like a local grand rounds when I talked to other doctors or non-retina specialists. It's just sort of wrapping our heads around like the loading with a different drug and then switching. I don't think most of us had done that. I know people, the companies have referenced the Iluvien example. I personally don't think Iluvien ever got a substantial enough market share where most retina specialists are comfortable with that model. I think there's a small group of people who used it quite frequently and used it with great, I think in their hands, great efficacy. But I feel like most of us are not used to that. Most people use a drug until it stops working or until they want to extend with durability. But they're not generally planning, I'm going to do this drug this many times and then switch to this other one. But thoughts on these drugs or anything about implementation, if they are available on the market.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is going to be really exciting. I mean, I think these are the most exciting things in terms of like, DR, DME, wet AMD, or the TKIs. And, our trainees are often like asking about these things and, what I think is going to work and what I don't think is going to work. I think we just have to wait for the phase three. I think you're totally right. It's like a different a mindset or like way of approaching things because I think we're so used to monotherapy and that's just not what it's going to be here. You'd have to load with something else and then switch over. I mean, it'd also be hard to imagine though that like insurance would approve you using one of these without loading, even if that made sense from a biological perspective. But it's interesting because like other fields, like these medicines, for instance, are really used in oncology. But like in other fields, like oncology, like you like monotherapy for any disease is like unusual. It's much more common to have like multiple things on board. So I think it's just a different way of thinking. I think the companies are gonna, obviously if you're academically inclined, you've been keeping up to date with the trials, you kind of know this, but otherwise it's gonna be for sure a different mindset and there's gonna have to be a fair amount of education. But I'm excited that some of these seem to have activity via other signals too. Like Priya mentioned in our article that vorolanib has some JAK2 activity, which might, give us some IL-6 activity. So I think there's really interesting things. It'll be interesting to see how the phase three stuff plays out. Obviously, with like vorolanib, we've got the phase two, so we have a little bit, I think, of a better sense of what might happen. But with axitinib, they just went from phase one to phase three, and those trials are structured differently than I think we're kind of used to seeing. So I'm excited to see what happens with the phase three stuff for those two.
Yeah, I think it's super interesting. All those things, especially the mechanism thing, is really interesting, Kat. And so this is something that like I find the mechanism thing interesting because I do think that retina specialists are obviously a little bit on the scientific research-based side, and I think we're results-based though. I think like we like the result, and then we like to go back and be like, okay, the mechanism makes sense to explain the result. But I don't think people chase mechanisms, and that's something that people have different feelings about. I agree with you, Kat. I think the mechanism thing is really fascinating, but historically, Sarwar, like Vabysmo, like are people choosing to use Vabysmo because they're like, oh, I get VEGF-A and Ang-2, or are they using it more because of the drying data or the durability data? I would argue when I talk to people anecdotally, it's more the latter than the former. With Eylea, when it first came out, they said, well, it's not just doing VEGF-A, you also get PDGF, right? And again, I think most people are like, I don't use it because of that. It's like nice to know that it has that. And maybe that explains why I like it in my hands. But I don't think it compelled anyone to be like, I prefer this to Lucentis at the time. I think really what compelled people was Protocol T and some other papers where they're like, this is why I choose Eylea over Lucentis at that time. And I think right now it's the same sort of thing. Because I think the cat said there's a lot of potential benefits to targeting other pathways. Maybe in DR, it helps in terms of apoptosis. That's something that's been discussed with like senescence inhibitors that are in trial. Maybe for AMD, do these patients get less GA over time? There's no way to know that in these sort of trials because they're not designed to capture for that long. But maybe it helps because there's targeting more than one pathway and reduces inflammation that may result in GA. I'm not purporting those things, but I'm saying in the end, I don't think anyone's going to change what they do because of the mechanism. I think it's going to be like that treatment burden reduction and or how much time did you get between treatments in your trials. But I don't know, maybe I'm not hanging out with the right crowd of retina people. What do you think, Sarwar? What do you think is really going to compel people to switch?
I mean, great points all around. I agree completely with regards to being results-based. And like what comes to mind is Ozurdex for me. I'm a big steroid utilizer for DME and RVO. But when I co talked to my colleague early on, a lot of it, like a lot of the marketing and the discussion was like, oh, look, there's these like, reduced hyperreflective foci and, we're targeting multiple pathways. And we know that, but like what makes me use it and what's, gotten a lot of like colleagues of mine to like start using it who didn't use it before is the fact that wow, true. Like, look at this stubborn edema that is chronic looking, responds really nicely, and you get better long-term control and reduce the likelihood of rescue injections in between. And I think you hit it right on the money. It's more results based. I actually also think it's really cool that we're hitting all these other pathways. Like things that come to mind is like, all right, we get better drying effect. I think that's great, but it's not black and white, right? Like for example, we always talk about like, how much subretinal fluid do you tolerate in AMD? Is that like a is complete drying, is some fluid actually protective for vision? So there's things that the questions that'll come up as we learn more about these drugs. So I think it's super
Yes.
interesting. What I love is that, the initial data is super promising. I like the idea that we're reducing treatment burden, but like it always comes back for me, as Kat mentioned, is, the insurance coverage, right? Like I'm thinking about, like for example, I think, faricimab and aflibercept HD are great medications, but I actually have a lot of trouble getting that for my patients who are on like managed medical plans and things like that. The patients who would actually benefit from it the most, right? And like that's where the challenge is going to be. And I think some utilization actually depends on how easy it is to get things covered, how easy it is to like get these medications for our patients, and also reimbursement. Like if you think about it, think about like the port delivery system, right? I've complained about this before. Like I don't do port delivery system. I like the idea of doing it. It sounds great, but like, is it worth the pittance of a reimbursement that we get for that specific procedure? The mechanistic data I think is interesting. I mean, like whenever I see the faricimab, like, oh, look at the FA showing reduced leakage 2 months after faricimab because you're targeting these other pathways. It's super interesting, but like you said, at the end of the day, it's about results and extension.
Yeah, and the one thing that's interesting, Kat, and you can comment before we switch subjects, like part of the way that people have gone around insurance issues and the companies have incentivized physicians to like use their product still is samples, right? But I'm wondering at what point for a company, like there's two reasons to use samples, right? From a company perspective, from our perspective, it's great. We get access to the patient, you have to bring them back. Sometimes you can just sample and move on. But it made a lot more sense for the company in an era where it's like you're sampling, but now you're switching them and they're gonna get the financial benefit, right? Because you're going to keep that patient on the treatment. The other reason to use samples is to get people comfortable so that the next patient they see, they think of it or fight for the reimbursement. But I'm just curious, there's going to be a tipping point, right? Like as the drugs get more and more durable, which is good, it becomes less weirdly less and less beneficial to the company in some way to give a sample. Because what if you sample that person and now they don't need an injection for a year? And I'm from the patient perspective and the doctor perspective, you're happy because you got a result. But that's a really interesting question. Like if we start moving to drugs in the future that last 2 years or 3 years or 5 years or 10 years, it's much less likely you're going to get a sample of that because now they've lost somebody forever that, and plus the drug's probably more expensive at baseline, right? I would imagine it's priced based on that.
Do you just have to go find your person to give you a sample every 6 months for this? I don't know. It's funny because samples don't factor into like my mindset at all. I actually forget that people get samples because we're not allowed to have samples. We're formally actually not allowed to have samples of A-reds, vitamins, or artificial tears actually to give to patients at all. So, but it'd be interesting. I think an interesting question is like, has the use of samples gone down over time? I don't know.
We're going to switch gears and talk about the environment, which is not something we normally talk about. The environmental
We love
impact.
the earth.
I love the environment, but it's great that we're talking about it. The environmental impact of fluorinated gas in retinal surgery. Scott McClintock, Jake Groski, Jeff Emerson. And I like this because I believe Scott McClintock, if I'm not mistaken, he also wrote a paper a couple years ago about the impact on carbon emissions for flying to the Academy meeting. Do we remember this? Like, I don't remember if you guys were on for that, but that paper came out. So this is about, like, I'll just summarize. So obviously they talk about we use gas for surgery, right? We use gas for pneumatics. And actually, the gases that we use are significant greenhouse gases. They are problems. They're fluorinated and they have high global warming potential. There's a term called GWP per 100. And SO6 is, on that scale, is 24,300. Compare that to CO2, which is 1, and C3F8, which is 9,290. And so this is just an interesting discussion, is that greenhouse gases, they go into how greenhouse gases are bad. And this is, again, environmentalism never should become politicized. I don't want people to write in and be like, why are you talking about global warming? But there is an association between greenhouse gases and climate change. And the most interesting part of this is they come up with estimates of how much SF6 per retina doctor per year, and they estimated 2 kilograms. And if that's a national total of 6,252 kilograms in 2024, and that's over 150,000 metric tons of CO2e. And so basically, they're saying there are rising amounts of SF6 emissions. They also say it could just be inaccuracies in the calculation or in the calculation. And they talk about strategies to reduce gas. And they talk about maybe there's different ways that we probably burn a lot of the gas, right? They talk about waste. We're not using a lot of the gas that's going in the eye. A lot of it gets, either left open, it gets wasted during purge cycles, the canister is expired prior to full usage. Anyway, it's an interesting concept. And Kat, I remember hearing about this when Alcon was coming out with like their single use thing that they talked about greenhouse gases and how it saves. And then people were like, well, I remember Rishi saying it was a metric years, was like, I don't know if you can make the environmental impact because now you're adding the plastics of what you do, which environmentalism is always really, really hard. So I don't know what our thoughts are. I thought this was interesting. I think it's interesting to think about. It makes me feel better when I use C3F8 instead of SF6. I don't know. I know every bit adds up, so I don't want to be irresponsible as a retina doctor. I also understand that that amount, it's like the whole thing about the emissions going to the Academy meeting. I believe, like, obviously you make the whole with very, very small missteps. I just believe these are very small things in the grand context of all the other uses of these gases. I don't think it modifies anything I would do, but maybe I am just in denial. What do you think?
I really appreciated this article because I actually like learned why we use the gases we use and about their properties. I, to be honest, just had no idea beforehand. I remember, I think there was a talk at like, maybe it was at VBS, it's just about like, and it made me think about the way we use gas in patients too. Like, like there's a lot of morbidity associated with these that like people are really down, for a while where they can't see. And so it's interesting that maybe what's better for the environment from a gas perspective is to use a longer acting gas. But, my patients hate it when, they have C3F8. They just want to get to Florida before, it gets cold here. But I kept thinking while I
You can
was
drive from
reading,
Cleveland. It's a flat
don't
drive.
like to drive. People don't like to drive.
One.
But I was thinking as you were while I was reading this article, I was like, huh, so is the solution to use like Unify, I think is the name that Alcon has for the things, and like, or all these other things, and like how much like waste, just paper waste and like plastic waste goes along with all these things, and isn't that worse overall?
100 wrongs don't make the 101st thing right, but this is a whole conversation about waste in general. Like, and I was just like, well, maybe Alcon could have made the packaging recyclable and like, or compostable, and this one's compostable. But then that's still like, of all the things you open in surgery, you'd have to have a recycling bin for that one thing because nothing else is recycled. Everything else is thrown away. And it's kind of a depressing topic. But on the one hand, I feel maybe it's my justification. If we're wasting, it's not good to waste in every situation. It's better to waste at least to save someone's vision than all the other productions of waste in the world in other fields. But Sarwar, I don't know how you feel about this.
I mean, I don't know. I really like this article because this is something I've been thinking about a lot actually lately. I mean, just because I do think every little bit adds up, even if like it's a tiny little thing, it's nice to know that we contribute, even though if it's like a little, not even a drop in the ocean, right? But what I thought you think is interesting is I like the solutions that they propose, right? Because there's a lot of variability in like, all right, why is it that we're utilizing so many more canisters than we do. And then it reminds me of like for example, like the idea of wasting gas, right? Because to get rid of the gas that's in the regulator. Like I've seen people do five wastes, right? But you know, it's but like I've actually over time I've tried to reduce the number of wastes that I do because the actual, I mean, I don't remember the actual volume. The volume of the regulator, that's what you're trying to purge,
Right.
right? And there's specific ways to use the gas. And I don't know if all staff are equally trained. For example, you turn on the gas canister, you only mess with the regulator,
Right. Some
right?
people are
There are
messing with both. Yes.
You're wasting gas basically. And there are some tricks, you know, I think we should actually do some kind of study on this. If you guys are down, I think it'd be kind of cool because like there's a way to minimize the amount of gas that you waste by using a three-way stopcock and like a male-to-male adapter on like your gas canister. And then you basically like just do one turn. And because sometimes if you don't use a three-way stopcock, then you end up like losing gas in between. So there's several ways to do
When
it.
you
Also,
unscrew and rescrew, yeah.
yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
You're wasting gas during that time. Also, like it's a set volume. Most regulators are about the same size. So I think we can come up with a standardized protocol. Like, okay, good. We get it. You want pure 100% gas. You know, use a smaller gas canister like the paper says. And also like you don't need to do more than one waste. I honestly think if you do one waste, you're good to go because you've purged the gas canister. I'm sorry, purged the volume of the regulator. I think it'll be really great actually because I think there's so much variability because people are like, oh my God, what if there's a little bit of air in there? Then I'm not going to get 100% SF6 or C3F8. And I think we can come as a society, as like a community, we can come up at least with this little area.
Yeah.
We come up with a way of saying, all right, you know what? If you do one purge, you are very likely to get 100% gas. And then we let everybody know. So there's less variability there.
This is the whole question too, is like we're always trying to chase perfection, but is it meaningful? So most fields, I read about this when I read this paper. When they purge gas, they are purging from a safety standpoint, but it's not an infection standpoint. It's to get rid of unwanted gases because there are situations when you're manufacturing that you don't want gases, mostly oxygen, because oxygen is flammable and combustible, and you don't want it in your chemical process, right? So you don't want that involved. So you're trying to get no oxygen in. It's different for us because the eye is already filled with air. We aren't doing a perfect purge when we are in the eye, even if we've talked about this before, when you push the gas, however way you exchange your air to your gas at the end, right? As you push the gas, you are getting closer and closer to the percentage you are getting to, but it's not magic. There's still a little bit of the air left, and you're mixing the gas with air. So our goal is not to get rid of the oxygen or make it pure because we're not using it in a pure form. So the only thing you're trying to do, to your point, Sarah, is try to get as close to your desired percentage as possible. But the question is, how meaningful is it? If you're like, we all think, okay, I injected 14% through your C3F8. But we're not like measuring it down to like the micrometer
Hypogram.
mic or microliter, right? Like it is an estimate because in my hands, when I do 14% and I draw it this way, it lasts this long and it fills and it fits the mold. Like if you didn't do that purge, let's say that purge doesn't get you to 100% CAT, it probably is not going to affect the patient outcome drastically because anyway, you're pushing so much of that in to mix it with the air. That, yeah, you're probably maybe you don't get to 14%, but if it's 12% or 12.5%, it probably won't matter in most cases. I don't know. I'm just playing devil's advocate agreeing with you, Sarwar, but maybe even measuring the purge volume doesn't matter. The purge is more of a leftover, I think, from other fields and for us to feel like, oh, we purged it. So you're not going to get an infection from this gas that's been sitting. Why would, but that's what brings the whole question is like, we put room air through the sterile filter. But like half the times the valves sometimes don't work as you're closing. There's room air circulating in there. So I guess you're just trying to minimize exposure, but it's not as like airtight as we think it is.
No, I think people just get so anxious about getting a good gas fill. I mean, the amount of times that we are like getting to the gas point of our procedure and then somebody realizes the tank has been opened and it's actually empty. Like, what happened there? things just like disappear.
Yes.
And I don't know, maybe if we get TKIs on the market, we will have less trash for
Oh,
using injections
that
all
should not be
the
number one, two, or three, though, in there. But maybe you inject
time.
less.
We'll have
Yeah.
less garbage from all the injection packaging.
So.
Also, like another side thing, sorry, one quick point. Like, there's so much trash in our clinics, right? You know, like for example, all the little boxes, right? All the little boxes that all the pre-filled syringes come in, like the little cute, like
plastic container for like the Vabysmo prefilled syringe. It's so nice, but like, what am I gonna do with that? Like, and it just goes into the garbage, and I just don't like that. And I think there are people working on sustainability in these fields, so I'm optimistic about that.
Let's end. There's two articles that aren't really scientific, but just more holistic. And I'll mention them both together because we can limp the discussion because you guys have been generous with your time. One was by Tom Ciulla, who was a retina specialist for a long time and now, works on the pharma side. And currently is the president of a company called Ikarovek and the CEO. And he talks a little bit about best practices for clinical research. And I would suggest anyone who's interested in getting involved in clinical research, whether you're a fellow that's going to join a practice or you're in your own practice, you want to start clinical research, it's not as easy as people make it look. It is doable, but there's work involved. And I would just say if my take home from this would be there are a lot of do's and don'ts. And generally, the more better you are at A, enrolling patients, but also being really good about your documentation and compliance, the more likely it is that companies will continue to come back to them. They're not doing it to give you a hard time, but there is a lot of regulatory overhead to make sure they maintain records correctly and they capture things so that when we come on this podcast and talk about clinical trial results, we talk about them with the assumption that they're meaningful and it's not just, someone messed up documentation everywhere and this is actually not what happened during the trial. The second is by Jonathan Lin, who's at Stanford as a fellow, and it was talked about what to look for in a retina fellowship. And again, anyone who's looking at retina fellowship this year or in future years, it's a great read. He talks about balancing learning style, mentors, what's the setting, private versus academic, and then geography. It's a very, I don't, again, for us, I don't think for any of us it was really groundbreaking, not to, but mostly because we're past that stage. But I think for people who are in that decision-making process, it's important to recognize. So, Kat, I'll just quickly ask you, you can comment on either one of these articles. Any further points you would make either way? I mean, this is the season that people are deciding their rank list for fellowships. And what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think Jonathan Lin did a really nice job summarizing, which is like find a place that works for you. He also really, one of his main points was making sure that you jive with the people who would be teaching you, because these people are your mentors and they're going to be the ones advocating for you getting a job and early career opportunities. One of the things that I've really heard from sort of people who've been applying lately and recent fellows is that they really feel like, while there maybe used to be these clear tiers of fellowships, that it's like not really that way anymore, and that there's actually a fair amount of like really good fellowships and you just need to find the right fit for you, right? Or maybe it used to be like, I need to go to one of these three places, and if I'm not, then like, that everything is different. But I think it's just really about finding the right fit for you. And I think that message was really good. Like, think about who you are, do some soul searching, and then what's right for you might not be right for someone else.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I thought about that reading the clinical trial article, like back to back, is like, if you're reading this and this sounds horrible and you don't want to deal with it, then you don't have to deal with it. You don't have to do clinical trials to live a happy and productive career. But I think it's a very obvious place. Sometimes people are like, oh, like people are just doing clinical trials because they get reimbursed really well and it makes them a lot of money and it's easier than doing practice. And I would say, look, there are obviously financial incentives for people in practice doing clinical trials. It's still a lot of work. You're still doing a lot of work and it's just a different type of work. You're not fighting with an insurance company for reimbursement. Or seeing 60 patients that day, you see a couple of research patients, but you still are responsible for the integrity of the data and following all these compliance rules. Otherwise, why would a company choose to work with you?
Yeah, great point. I mean, I thought both these articles were great. Clinical trials are something that I'm thinking about adding to my practice as I've gotten busier. But, like I have the visual acuity chart, but like, one of the things that I think are critical is having the attention to detail. And I think this article reminded me of how important it is to have a good clinical trial coordinator, someone with a who, is your basically your right hand when it comes to, quality of the processes that are in place. And I just think, I do think from my friends who do clinical trials, like I hear that's extremely rewarding. But if you're setting it up, it requires a lot of forethought. So like it sort of reminds me of how much work I still have left to do to get to that point. So, and it was a reminder of some of the things that can go wrong and how important it is to have processes in place to avoid that. With the fellowship trial, I thought it was very well written as well. It reminded me of like finding your best fit, right? Like I hear stories from people like, oh, like I went to this fellowship and I just feel like, like we're just labor for the, and it applies to residency too, right? Like, so I think it's important to like one additional piece of advice is talk to people who were recently there and people with a good track record. And also like a various styles of teaching, right? Some, like at my fellowship, there were some attendings. I loved my fellowship. It was at UIC. I loved my attendings. But there were some people who are a bit more like flap your wings, bird, you know, like hey, a baby bird, you
They
know.
push you out the window and say,
Yeah,
don't fall.
it's time to fly. Whereas other ones, it was more graduated, and having that variability, I think was really helpful because I picked up different things from different attendings. Yeah, I think learning your, like, you know, figuring out your learning style is super important. Like I'm more of like a throw me in there, you know, we'll figure it out, you know, just give me a little guidance. But like that's not for everybody, you know.
Yeah, and I was gonna just comment last thing on that. And Kat, you brought this up and sorry you're referencing it. I just think you have to understand you're gonna spend a lot of time with these people. And they're gonna have to spend a lot of time with you. I think in residency, you spend a lot more time in some programs with your co-residents and/or your patients, but probably not as much time with your attendings, depending on the program. You spend time with them, but it's not the same concentration of a few people because there's usually enough different subspecialties. But I think for retina, it can range from one person to 15 or 20, depending on where you train. But you spend a lot of time with the concentration of being in a very high pressure cooker environment with that person sometimes for 7, 8, 9, 10 hours in the OR or the clinic. You just have to like if you really can't get along in an interview setting where everyone's on their best behavior, maybe it's not the right fit, as you said. It may not be the place that you want to be. And if you're like, wow, I really enjoyed being around these people or these co-fellows, et cetera, that's meaningful. But in a weird way, Kat, I think you most places you spend more time with your attendings than with your co-fellows for sure.
100%. You know, it's different than residency because for fellowship, you know, a big component for surgical retina fellowship is surgery. And so you're like literally next to that person like all day long, you know, and then you're in the trenches with them. And yeah, it's just a different world. I mean, I think you get excited when you get to be around your co-fellows, but you're more constant is going to be your attending.
People stay with you forever, though. It's kind of cool. Like I like some of my surgical mannerisms are like a lot like Paul Chan or Yannick Lederman, who are like of my like you know people who had a really important impact. So like when I'm like operating, I'm like, is the infusion on and unclamped? I'm like, oh, that's Yannick. You know what I mean? So like these people stay with you. These habits imprint. So I think it's important where you go.
It's your first opportunity to semi-pick your parents in a way. You
Yeah.
sort of pick them for residency, but there's so many. It's not like one or two people imprint that much unless you had a really impactful mentor. But I think for retinal surgery, you're kind of picking the people who are gonna, like you said, there's gonna be at least one or two people that you are modeling after, if not more. So anyway, I appreciate you guys' time. I hope you have a wonderful end of the year and holiday season. And thanks for joining for this podcast.
Thanks, Jay.
Thanks, Jay. Happy 10.
Many thanks to Drs. Talcott and Zahid for coming on for this episode. Thanks to the team at Retinal Physician for providing the articles in advance. Special shout out to our whole production team. That includes Drs. Justin Ma and Louis Kai, as well as Justin Zhang, our latest addition to the production team. Listeners, thank you for listening. You can all find all 484 of our episodes as we end year 9 and head in now to year 10 of the Retina Podcast. You can find them all at retinapodcast.com. You can reach out to me at any point by clicking on the contact us link on our website or by emailing me directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for all you do taking care of patients, publishing articles, and inspiring conversation here. This is Jay Schreather signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.